What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986. What's stopping
you? Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Happy Friday to you. Welcome again to Call to Communion. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, you're kind of looking around for answers, you're trolling your buddies, and can't quite get those answers, well, why not give us a call? Here's our number, 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response. It'll come real quick. And then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates apply. Again, the phone number 833-288-EWTN, or you could pose your question via Facebook or YouTube. We are streaming right now. Michael Birchfield is our producer. Matt Kubinski is our phone screener. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Great. Great.
That's pretty great.
Oh, it is great. I'm a blessed man, and I know that you are as well. We were talking about it before the show.
Lots to be thankful for.
Oh, absolutely. What's going on for the weekend?
Well, my parents are celebrating their anniversary this weekend.
Fantastic.
And I'm thinking, let's see. Okay, so 56, be 56 years.
Wow.
And so they're having a big shindig. You know, my dad, as you know, is not in good health, and
no.
that's an understatement,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And anyway, so you read into that what you will, but they're
mm-hmm.
having a kind of a big blowout sort of shindig and inviting relatives from all over the place, and so we're going to hang out with the relatives and celebrate my parents.
Sounds like a lot of fun. We're going to lead off today with an email from Linda, who says, "Hey, Dr. Anders, I take communion to the homebound, and one of them is elderly, and informed her daughter that when her husband joined the church and had his first marriage annulled, the son of his first marriage will be considered a..." Seven letters rhymes with starts with a B.
Okay.
In the eyes of the church, could you expound on this?
Okay, so lay out the genealogy again. Maybe whose child? Lost track of that.
I take communion to the homebound. Mm-hmm. One of them is elderly.
Elderly homebound.
And that person informed her daughter that when her husband joined the church and had his first marriage annulled, the son of that first marriage would be considered.
Oh, got you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
In the eyes of the church.
Thank you. Well, no. That's not how it works. Okay, so the word, let's use the less inflammatory word of illegitimate.
Okay.
Well, what do you mean when you're, what does it mean to ascribe legitimacy or illegitimacy to a child? Well, these are not terms that have any sort of theological significance relative to the life of grace.
Mm-hmm.
They're not terms that affect anything to do with our Catholic identity or our suitability to receive the sacraments, and the only other domain in which that would make any sense would be in civil law with respect to inheritance or, you know, lines of succession or whatever you might have.
Mm-hmm.
And in none of those domains does the question that you're raising have any relevance or purchase in modern Catholic life. So I'm not even sure what the significance of raising the distinction is. Now, you know, obviously, there are circumstances in which questions of, you know, lawful inheritance or legitimacy, if you will, or parental responsibility and parental rights. I mean, these kinds of things can come play in the civil domain. But with respect to, you know, who has the right and obligation and duty within the Catholic Church to care for children, or, you know, who can present a child for baptism, or whose responsibility is it to raise a child in the church? I mean, the church has spoken to this question very clearly. If that couple has children, biological, adopted, or otherwise, that they claim as their own, and the church recognizes that relationship, you know, the backstory doesn't matter from the point of view of the church.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you're just, I mean, you comb through the code of canon law and try to find that distinction that you're drawing applied in this particular circumstance. You're not going to find it.
Very good. Linda, thank you so much for your email. Hope that's helpful for you. Here's one from Tricia now. And she says, I work at a Catholic hospice. We have a Protestant chaplain who works with us at the hospice. Is someone who is not a Catholic allowed to give Holy Communion?
So could the Protestant chaplain administer a consecrated host to someone who was Catholic?
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that I haven't specifically examined the rubrics or the canons on that exact question, but I get a very queasy feeling about it. Mm. I get a very queasy feeling about that. And I would say that's whether or not that has been specifically prescribed, and I honestly can't tell you if there's a statute in the law that says, you know, you can't do that, that strikes me as extraordinarily inadvisable.
Yeah. Okay.
And I would, you know, I'd like to do a little bit more research and make sure that there aren't, I mean, there may be an exception to that. The principle may, you know, I'm out of my league here because we're talking about the niceties of, you know, canon law and liturgics. So I will double check.
Perhaps a canon lawyer could give us a call.
A canon lawyer maybe could give us a call, but I will tell you that that gives me a very queasy feeling.
Yeah, okay. This is Called to Communion here on EWTN. 833-288-EWTN is our number. Usually the phones are on fire on Fridays, so if you want to call in, this would be a good time to do that. 833-288-3986. Here's an email from Terry who says, Dr. Anders, if Adam and Eve would not have made that first sin, or committed that first sin, I guess, would it have happened sooner or later with their descendants because they are human and have free will? Also, if both Adam and Eve were born without sin, would they not experience concupiscence? So unlikely to be drawn to commit sin or rebel. Any thoughts on those?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. So first of all, Adam and Eve, in the condition in which God created them, had the gift of sanctifying grace. Like the Blessed Virgin Mary, who had sanctifying grace from the first moment of her conception. That's what we mean by the Immaculate Conception.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they weren't conceived in the normal way, but we might speak of their Immaculate Creation. You know, they were created with grace in union with God. And as an outflow of that grace, they also had certain gifts that affected them in their nature.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So these are not necessary concomitants of grace because we don't have them. You can have grace today, but these don't necessarily follow. But they did in Adam and Eve. They were gifts. Preternatural gifts is the technical term. One of those was the gift of integrity. And the gift of integrity meant that Adam and Eve had perfect control over their passions so that their reason could rule their passions. And the inability or the difficulty that reason has in ruling the passions in us leads to concupiscence, so that we are immoderately attached to bodily pleasure. Adam and Eve were immune from concupiscence until after the fall, when they lost the preternatural gifts. So had they persevered and had their progeny retained sanctifying grace from their conception, and in fact, yeah, then they would also presumably have lacked concupiscence. Now, the first question, if Adam and Eve had not fallen, Could humanity have been lost in the sin of one of their progeny? That's a good question. It's an entirely speculative question. The data of Revelation is not addressed to such questions. It's addressed to the actual condition of the human race. We come into the world in a fallen way, lacking sanctifying grace, lacking the gift of integrity, needing to be reborn in Christ. What would have happened under other circumstances is not something divine revelation speaks to. But I would say that, just theoretically, just speculatively, it's pretty clear that Adam and Eve stood in a very particular relationship to the human race. Adam was the head of the race in a sense, and we were all in Adam.
Mm-hmm.
In a kind of union with him that is unique, that's different from the way I'm in union with other members of the human species. And so I think there would be kind of a presumption in favor of, you know, had Adam persevered, that might have had downstream benefits in the same way that his fall had downstream consequences. But again, I'm now operating outside what God has actually revealed. I'm just trying to think like a speculative theologian. So there's a question that comes up in medieval theology it's not the same question, but it's analogous in that it's a speculation about what would have happened. There was a debate in the Middle Ages about whether or not Christ would have become incarnate had Adam not sinned. And Thomas Aquinas says no, because the only purpose or reason for the incarnation that God has revealed to us is to redeem from sin.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to stick with that. John Duns Scotus took a different line and said, yeah, the incarnation is such a great thing, it would have happened anyway. But of course, he's just shooting from the theological hip here, because you know, nothing in Revelation compels us to that conclusion.
Okay, very good. Terry, thank you so much for your email. By the way, if you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we'll be talking with Chris, driving through North Carolina right now. And look at this, line open for you, 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN.
Sharing the fullness of the Catholic faith. 1-833-288-EWTN. 1-833-288-3986. This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Catholic Answers Live is on EWTN television.
Catholic Answers Live is one of the longest running and most listened to Catholic radio programs of all time, and now it's also a TV show. I think you'll really get a different take from the TV show. The Bible quote or catechism paragraph the speaker is explaining can be put up on the screen, along with helpful graphics and other related material that really bring the topic to life.
Catholic Answers Live, TV, Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN television.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
You know, maybe we need to ask ourselves, do we really know Jesus? Maybe another way to ask that would be, how familiar are you with the Gospels? When I was living in D.C., I was on the plane taking a late flight home, sitting next to a young girl. She was probably 16, 17. I had my collar on, and we got talking, and she said, somehow in the course of the conversation, she acknowledged that she was running away from home and was in the midst of an awful lot of difficulties that were going on. Her story seemed to be remarkably akin to the story of the prodigal son, which we just heard this past Sunday at Mass, huh? And so I started to speak a little bit about that with her. And I said, you sound a little bit like the younger son in the story of the prodigal son. And she looked at me like I was from Mars. And I said, are you not familiar with the story of the prodigal son? And she says, no, never heard it. And I just looked at her and I says, oh my goodness, are you in for a wonderful evening?
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. 1-833-288-EWTN. 1-833-288-3986.
Hey, this weekend here on EWTN Radio, don't miss Pro-Life Weekly with Catherine Hedro. That'll be Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern. This week, members of Congress show support for the Protect Life Rule. Also, Pastor Clenard Howard Childress Jr. discusses the alarming black abortion rate. They say it is the highest cause of death in the black community is abortion. Also, a British cabinet minister calls on Pope Francis to change the church teachings on contraception. Well, we'll see if that happens. Anyway, that's coming up Sunday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern, and also 8:30 p.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We begin with Chris, driving through North Carolina, listening on Sirius XM 130. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, why is blood so important for the of sins in the Old Testament, first with animal sacrifice, and then in the New Testament with Jesus Christ?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So when you go back to Old Testament sacrifices, the real key ingredient in Old Testament sacrifices is that the worshiper has given up something of value All right. That's why not all Old Testament sacrifices required the sacrifice of an animal. There were other sacrifices where the worshiper might give up, say, agricultural produce. We even have evidence in the book of Genesis of the patriarchs pouring out oil upon stones because, look, you got a big jar of olive oil, costs you a lot of money, you dump it out on the stone, you don't have it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The idea is to offer up something to God that costs you, okay, in token of reparation or thanksgiving or prayer or whatever the intention of the sacrifice is, you're marking your willingness to sacrifice by actually giving something up. Now, when it comes to how do you give up an animal to God? If you're a farmer and that's your asset base right there, how do you give up an animal to God? Well, if you march an animal into the temple and go, "Here, God, I'm giving you this animal," and then you march it right back out again and take it home, you hadn't really given it up.
Yeah.
The immolation, the slaughter of the animal, is necessary to deprive yourself of its use. Now, in the ancient world, in ancient physiology, if you will, there was a strong association between the idea of blood and the actual life force of the animal. So, in addition to slaughtering the animal, the actual spilling of its blood, kind of the equivalent of dumping the oil out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is the thing that makes the animal go. All right, so I'm taking the principle of life, of vital activity, sucking out of this animal carcass and offering it to God. And because in the physiology of the time, if you will, blood had that almost kind of mystical significance as
mm-hmm.
sort of the source of life.
Uh-huh.
Blood, the idea of gift or sacrifice or atonement in Hebrew is etymologically related to the same word that is used for ransom. Right, so if you ransom a captive, you know,
uh-huh.
you have to give up something of value to
sure.
get your captive back. So that's why when Jesus says the Son of Man is going to come and give his life as a ransom for many,
mm-hmm.
that note of ransoming is connected to the note of sacrifice. So here you have this intrinsically powerful stuff, blood, that's the principle of life that I'm going to pour out in token of my oblation, that I'm giving up something of value to God. And so I can then use that blood in other ritualistic ways. So another purpose of sacrifice in the Old Testament was ritual purification. God is holy, he's awesome, he's powerful. I have to be very careful when I approach the divine presence. And so Levitical law specified states of ritual purity and impurity in which it was lawful for me to either approach or not approach the divine presence to offer sacrifice. In a very small way, we invoke that idea all the time through what you might call manners. There are ways of dressing, behaving, and speaking that we in the modern world would accept in one context that we would not accept in another. When I was a child, I was always told to put on my Sunday best
yes.
to go to church.
Mm-hmm.
It would be perfectly appropriate for me to wear a bathing suit to the pool, but not to church on Sunday. You see, that idea of you kind of have to make your best. You have to get your, you know, in order to
mm-hmm.
just not that there's anything intrinsically connected to my suit versus my bathing suit that makes God regard me well, but it's out of reverence and respect. And the Levitical law had the same kind of notion. Well, built into the concept of purity and impurity and cleanliness and uncleanliness, you could pass from a state of cleanliness into uncleanliness. And if you were unclean, you absolutely couldn't enter into the state of holiness. You couldn't go in and offer ritual sacrifice to God. You had to be ritually purified. And blood was one of the things that could be used to purify or consecrate sacred items and persons.
Hmm.
Okay. So it also had that function as well. So that's kind of the background of blood sacrifice in the Old Testament. And in the same way, when Christ makes the ultimate sacrifice of giving up his own life, again, how do you give up your own life? In the case of Christ, it was the separation of his body and his blood,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, explains why there are two elements in the holy sacrifice of the Mass. Why the body is represented and made to be present by mm-hmm. the species of bread,
mm-hmm.
and why Christ's blood is represented, made to be present also, by the species of wine. Because bread over here, wine over there, shown to be in a state of separation, represent Christ in a state of victimhood, namely with the separation of his body from his blood.
Wow. Beautiful. Chris, thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you. In fact, we have two lines open at the moment, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion here on EWTN. If you're ready, let's go to the Cayman Islands and talk with Quincy, listening to us on the EWTN app. Hey there, Quincy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. How are you doing today?
Very good, very good. What's your question today, Quincy?
I'm wanting to get some advice from you two scholarly gentlemen. I am Catholic. I'm a convert to the Catholic faith, as a matter of fact. My background would have been in Baptists and also the Methodists, so I'm a convert. I'm a convert to Rome, sweet home. The thing is, I've been attending a Baptist Bible study. Now, is this a good thing in the name of ecumenism, or should I refrain from going? And, you know, we differ when it comes to transubstantiation, the reason we go to confession to a priest, our devotion to Our Lady. What should I do? Should I cut ties then with this Baptist Bible study, or should I continue to go knowing that deep in my heart I am Catholic? Thank you.
Thanks, Quincy. I appreciate the call. I think a lot of it depends on what you intend to gain, why you intend to be present, how prepared you are to engage in that in a way to achieve your objectives. So, for instance, if your purpose is to enter into a genuine ecumenical dialogue where you respectfully examine the sacred text and the various positions that you and your participants take on it, so that you can understand one another and where you differ and where you're the same, and you feel sufficiently well formed in your faith that you can make a strong case for the Catholic point of view, it's going to be a lot more than just the question of transubstantiation. I think one of the biggest differences is about the nature of the Bible itself. I mean, if the premise of the Bible study is that the Bible is our sole rule of faith, then the whole premise of the thing is incorrect, because Jesus didn't give us the Bible as our sole rule of faith, but as an inspired witness to the life and teaching of Jesus and the apostles and the history of Israel, to move us closer to God, but not to be the final rule of faith for Christian life. So that's another thing you differ on. But if you feel well enough prepared as a Catholic to make a strong Catholic case and to have a reasonable dialogue on that basis, and you're there, you want to let your friends know what Catholics believe and you want to talk to them about what they believe, maybe that's an okay thing. If you're there because you think you're not well formed in your faith and you want to learn more about the Bible, well, everyone who picks up a text and reads it with a particular perspective, a particular context or point of view. Your friends are going to be reading it from a very non-Catholic perspective with non-Catholic premises. They're going to draw some wrong conclusions almost of necessity, and you want to be wary that you don't let them lead you down the wrong path. So I think it depends on why you're there and how well prepared you feel to exercise that ministry. So that's a prudential judgment that you can make for yourself, or that you could make perhaps in consultation with a spiritual director.
All right, Quincy, thanks for checking in from the Cayman Islands. We're delighted to hear from you today. This is Call to Communion here on EWTN. 1-833-288-EWTN is our phone number. Let's go now to Chris in Akron, listening on Living Bread Radio. Hey there, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how are you guys?
Very good. What's on your mind?
Okay, Dr. David Andrews, I got a question that I need to answer for my 8-year-old son, and it is related to Adam and Eve, too. I'm trying to help him to understand that he doesn't need or shouldn't hold against Adam and Eve for ushering in sin into the world, because any time I made the mistake of telling him how sin came about, and now anytime he gets into trouble, he says, "I hate that Adam and Eve." And I feel so bad about it, because I try to tell him, if it hadn't been them, somebody else would have come along and messed it up. But now, listening to you today, it sounds like if they had done it right, then we might have been able to escape sin entirely. So I just wondered if you could help me to explain it to him so that he can be more forgiving towards them.
Very good.
Yeah, sure. I have a couple things to say. First of all, it sounds like the 8-year-old is a clever attorney who's blame shifting. He's trying to dodge responsibility for his own actions. And we cannot blame Adam and Eve for our conscious fault. And assuming the child is baptized and in the church, he has access to sanctifying grace, which is there to heal the wounds of Adam and Eve. So he's really responsible for his own actions in every respect, and God is giving him all the grace that he needs to do what he's supposed to do. So don't let him skip out on moral responsibility by blaming his first parents. That's the kind of fatalism that we don't want to that we don't want to encourage. Secondly, God has forgiven Adam and Eve, and Christ says that if we don't forgive others, then we ourselves will not be forgiven. Now, that's kind of a heavy to lay on an 8-year-old. I don't know that I want to tell him that. But that's the perspective we ought to bring. There are people all around me all the time that do wrong, and I'm one of them.
Me too. Thanks so much for your call, Chris, and please say hi to your son for us. When we come back, we'll be talking with James in Atlanta, and we've got a line open for you right now, 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986. It's called the Communion.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
No Catholic can support abortion, and that Catholics are responsible to take serious action against legalized abortion.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Hi, I'm Doug Keck, and this is an EWTN Bookmark Brief. I just had the pleasure of interviewing Patricia Sandoval on her book, Transfigured. Tell us, Patricia, this book which you wrote with Christine Watkins, what is it about?
It's my life story. It's my testimony of, you know, being fooled by the whole safe sex, sexual education that I received as a child, and had 3 abortions. Thought I had aborted 3 sack of tissues, didn't think it was a baby, and I suffered tremendously after each abortion, what is called post-abortion syndrome, and then that's when I worked with Planned Parenthood, and I saw the truth. You know, and there's a lot of shame behind abortion. It's not easy telling your story, but with this book, I didn't hold back at all.
The book is Transfigured, Patricia Sandoval's Escape from Drugs, Homelessness, and the Back Doors of Planned Parenthood. She wrote along with Christine Watkins, and it is available through the EWTN Religious Catalog. Thank you so much. Check it out, and look for the entire interview coming soon on EWTN's Bookmark Show. I'm Doug Keck. This has been a Bookmark Brief.
On fire for EWTN? Get Amazon Fire TV. All you need is a high-speed internet connection, a TV, and the Amazon Fire TV player. Never miss any of your favorite EWTN television or radio programs again.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
I feel that God has been really doing a work in me in the last 5-10 years. I'm a convert to Catholicism, and I started to just really feel a passion to know more about the Catholic faith, and I started listening to Catholic radio all day. I'm not doing great things, but I'm doing small things with great love.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. 1-833-288-EWTN. 1-833-288-3986.
It's the Friday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. There's a line open for you at the moment, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Here is Luke checking us out today on YouTube, who says, I am Orthodox. Some reasons that we do not believe in the Immaculate Conception doctrine is that it presupposes a view of original sin that the Eastern Church does not. If the Holy Virgin was unlike all other women in nature, then the Lord Jesus Christ was not, quote, made like us in every way except sin. And it implies a Calvinist-like view that says God can make Mary different, quote, because he is God and he wanted to. I'd like to hear Dr. Anders' response to these differences.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, so I think that you misunderstand the doctrine of original sin, because the Catholic Church does not teach that Mary had a different nature from ours. And, in fact, the Catholic Church is extraordinarily adamant that Christ's human nature is the same as ours, and his in his humanity, precisely. Mm-hmm. If he had anything other than human nature, he had some other kind of nature, then he wouldn't have redeemed humanity. And he took that human nature from the Blessed Virgin Mary. So we don't believe that she had a different human nature. Keep in mind that the Catholic doctrine of original sin is that it is not actual sin. It is sin by analogy only. And it really amounts to a state of privation. It's that we have been denied something that Adam and Eve had. Not that there is something that is sort of squeezed into us like a tube of toothpaste. We haven't acquired some positive attribute or substance. It's rather that we lack the gift of sanctifying grace when we are born, and we have to receive that grace through baptism. Adam and Eve were given the gift of sanctifying grace from the moment of their creation. Now, the Orthodox Church does recognize Mary as the second Eve. And like the first Eve, Mary came into the world with a gift of sanctifying grace. Mm-hmm. But if you understand the Catholic doctrine of grace, you understand that grace does not destroy or alter nature or substantial form. It merely qualifies it in a supernatural way so that we can participate in the likeness of God, that doctrine that the Orthodox recognizes deification. Now, or theosis as the Greek word. The Orthodox also recognize Mary as immaculate, pure, or spotless. I believe it's akrontos in Greek. And there are many Orthodox that believe that she was free from actual sin, that she never sinned, and certainly that she died sinless. So I'm kind of trying to put these ideas together. And to me, and I know I'm not Orthodox, and I don't know all the ins and outs of Orthodox theology, but it seems that we end up affirming an awful lot of the same things about the Blessed Virgin Mary. She is the Theotokos. She is the all-holy, all-pure Panagia. She's the one that was without actual sin. She's the most perfect disciple in the school of Christ. She's the one that says, "Be it done to me according to thy word," and successfully cooperates with divine grace so that she enters into that state of theosis and is the holiest of the holy who intercedes on behalf of the Church. She's the second Eve. What Orthodox believer would want to predicate stain or spot or sin of the All-Holy One?
Yeah.
So, to my way of thinking, it's more in the way in which we conceive of original sin than it is the way we conceive of the actual nature or holiness of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And I'm tempted to say it boils down to a semantic difference about the way we draw theological distinctions. Mm. But I know when I say that kind of stuff, sometimes Eastern people say, "You're wrong, and here's why you're wrong." But that's sort of my reading of the thing.
Very good. Luke, thank you so much for checking us out today on YouTube. This is called Communion here on EWTN. 833-288-EWTN is our number. Let's go to James in Atlanta checking us out today on the EWTN app. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was raised Catholic. I raised my son Catholic. He's 18 now and going to a non-denominational church. And I asked him what are his main issues. And he said that one of them had to do with where the Bible says we are saved through faith from works so no one may boast, etc. And then further on he said he's come up with something called true faith. He says if someone has true faith, then by default that would produce works. So really, you just need true faith to get to heaven versus faith in works.
Hmm. Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I strongly recommend that you read the second chapter of the book of Romans very carefully and attentively. It's a chapter that a lot of times Protestants who are very fond of this faith and works dynamics neglect. They like to start with Romans chapter 3. They don't go back and look at Romans chapter 2. The reason I say that is because, well, go read the text, okay? But there's a lot in there. One of the things that Paul says is that it's not hearing the law that justifies us, it's obeying the law that justifies us. And he doesn't shy away from that very powerful statement. Mm-hmm. It's obedience to the law that justifies us, by which we will be declared righteous. And then he goes on to explain the dynamic. How is it that one, in fact, obeys the law? And what he says in verses 25 to 29 is it's through the gift of the Spirit and the circumcision of our heart that we come to obey the righteous requirements of the law, the dikaiomata tou nomou in Greek. He also goes on to say that the works of the law, the ergo nomou, fail to justify. But he tells us what they are. What are these works of the law that fail to justify? Well, it's all the prescriptions of the Mosaic Code. So it's not in virtue of being circumcised or avoiding pork or wearing certain clothing or performing certain rituals or ablutions that God is going to declare me righteous or a member of his family. It's when I have actually fulfilled the inner logic of the law, the spirit of the law, if you will, the command to love God and love neighbor, that I will in fact be declared righteous. And that comes by way of faith as a gift of grace through the Holy Spirit. So I think the first thing is that these faith and works people who get all bent out of shape with this, they just don't understand what Paul means by works. What's at issue in the book of Romans and Galatians is this. If I hand you a legal code, the Mosaic Law, the civil code of Alabama, whatever it might be, if I hand you the Hammurabi's code, you name it, if I hand you a legal code, Napoleonic code, and I say, here, go follow that, I have not just made you righteous.
That's true.
Maybe I've just made you more morally responsible because I've drawn to your conscious awareness a list of thou shalts and shalt nots that you're going to fail to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Handing you a legal code is not going to count you righteous before God. And the same thing was true of the Jews. And this is Paul's argument, that merely in virtue of the fact that they possess the law and the commandments doesn't make them acceptable to God. It's only the circumcision of the heart that takes place by the Spirit, that inner and moral transformation by which we will be declared righteous. So faith is the necessary instrument for the receipt of that Holy Spirit. But it is, in fact, in virtue of our moral obedience that we will be declared righteous. Now, I would also challenge your son and others to look at every passage of the New Testament that addresses the question of our final judgment. So you look at Matthew 25, or again, Romans chapter 2, or Revelation chapter 20. And I would challenge you to find one passage in the New Testament where we're ever told that Christ will pronounce us righteous on the basis of our faith. There isn't a one. Every time the Scriptures anticipate the future judgment, we are told that we will be judged on the basis of our works. There's no other standard that's ever articulated.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do those works in charity by which we will be saved? Well, when through faith we receive the gift of the Spirit and our hearts are changed so that we love God and love neighbor, which Romans 13:8 says is the fulfillment of the law.
James, thank you so much for your call. This is Call to Communion here on EWTN. We go now to Todd in Houston, listening on Guadalupe Radio 1430. Hey there, Todd. What's on your mind today?
Yes, my question also has to deal with judgment. Can you explain what happens at judgment on the sins that you have already confessed and been to reconciliation for?
Yeah, sure. You're certainly not held responsible for the sins that have been forgiven. Otherwise, forgiveness would have no meaning.
That's right.
Okay, so when the question of our judgment arises, first of all, there's the question of our inclination to sin, our attachment to sin, that we'll have to be purged of if we still have an attachment mm-hmm. to sin. And, of course, that varies from person to person. Some people actually achieve the state of perfection in this life such that they're not attached to sin. We call those people saints. And in them, there will be nothing to judge. The judgment will be the grand hurrah from Jesus. Well done, good and faithful servant.
Yeah.
Okay. Then there are those of us, the vast multitude of Catholics in whom there still remains some attachment to sin, but they are united to God in friendship. And so God is not going to pronounce judgment or sentence on sins that he's forgiven, but he will say, you know what? You could have worked on this a bit more. And so, here's your ticket for purgatory. All right. And then there are those people who are not united to God in friendship and who have unconfessed and unforgiven sins who will be held responsible for those eternally. So there you go.
Okay. Appreciate your call, Todd. Call to Communion here on EWTN.
I didn't deal with the question of penance. I should address penance.
Okay, go right ahead.
So when there is a sin that is forgiven, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do something to God to make up for the fault or the wound against justice. Just like if I back into Tom's car in the parking lot at EWTN and he says, it's okay, Anders, I forgive you. I still think he's going to want me probably to file the insurance claim and pick up the deductible. And that would be right for me to do. And it would be presumptuous of me to say, I accept your forgiveness. Thanks so much for picking up the bill. No, he's forgiven me. Our friendship is restored. We hadn't have any rupture there. But it's still the right thing for me to do, to pick up the deductible and file the insurance claim and do all the rest of it. In the same way with God. God forgives us. Our friendship with him is restored. But it's still right for us to make some act of reparation. That's the other thing that could be potentially judged in the just on the day of judgment. God says, well done, good and faithful servant. But you know, we still got a little bit left on that last. You didn't say that last Hail Mary after confession. So that's an extra 5 minutes in purgatory for you.
You know, it's funny you would say that because I came out after work one day. Oh, this is several months ago. And there was a note on my windshield under the wiper there. And somebody had left a note. It was from a woman who said, I am so sorry. My six-year-old opened her door a little too hard and, you know, knocked a big ding in your driver's door. And I hadn't even noticed it. Looked down. Sure enough, there was a nice little pockmark there. And she said, please contact my husband. We'll be glad to pay for any of this. She did the right thing.
Interesting. Did you get it fixed?
You know what? I didn't because it is a 20-year-old car, and I thought, I'm not going to put them through all that. I'm just going to say, you know what? When I finally do trade the car in, it's not going to make any difference because I'm probably going to drive it right to the landfill.
Mm-hmm.
That's just,
right.
You know, when you're a cheapskate, those things run kind of deep. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Let's go now to Barbara, listening in Washington State on Sacred Heart Radio. Hey, Barbara, what's on your mind today?
Thank you. I was born and raised in the Catholic Church. I married in the Catholic Church to a non-member. He was Mormon. And a few years after that, joined the Mormon Church. And in the meantime, divorced him, left the Mormon Church. My question is, am I still Catholic?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Thanks. I really appreciate the question. You certainly are Catholic. You certainly are Catholic. And so you can come on back. And obviously, you have to deal in the confessional with the problem, the rather large problem of the sin of apostasy. When you formally renounced the Catholic faith by joining the Mormon Church. That's a problem, but it's not a problem that can't be resolved in the confessional. That's just one of the things you're going to say you're sorry for when you're reconciled to the church. I don't know if you've remarried somebody else outside of the Catholic Church. If you have, that's going to set up another interesting thing. You're going to have to deal with the marriage tribunal and the question of whether or not the first marriage could lawfully be annulled and that kind of thing. But provided you hadn't married somebody else, and we don't have that added barrier, just have to deal with the particular sins of your life and reconciliation, and then you can come back to Holy Communion again. And so, I mean, this is something you could do Saturday afternoon.
There you go.
Do it today if you find a priest.
Yeah, Barbara, thank you so much for your call. Hope that's encouraging and helpful to you. Call to Communion here on EWTN. I want to take a moment to talk about the EWTN Media Missionaries. Now, who are these folks that we're talking about? Well, think about the entrance area in your church. There may be some pamphlets there from EWTN. There may be some window stickers or program guides or bookmarks. It could be anything. Those things don't get there on their own. They did not just march in the front door. Somebody had to put those there. That's what an EWTN media missionary does. They prayerfully take EWTN to parishes and the community through the print and electronic media that we provide. Now, let's go back for just a moment and think about that church entrance there at your parish. Maybe you haven't seen anything from EWTN and you're thinking, well, it would really be nice if there were some items there from EWTN. Well, maybe God is calling you to become an EWTN media missionary. Go to EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world. EWTNmissionaries.com. Back to the phones right now. Let's talk with Joe in Rochester, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Dr. Andrews. I love your show, first of all. Thanks for all your knowledge and wisdom. I'm experiencing some frustration because I am a Catholic and I am a revert, but I have a very strong connection with the Evangelical Church also in town, and I play on their worship team. And at the Catholic Church, our diocese has really gone back to a organ and, you know, music from the older centuries, which I'm really glad about that, you know, bringing back even Gregorian chant in some of the churches. And I totally respect that, but I just feel like with my skills and growing up as a rock and roller, I really don't have a place to use those skills in the church, and I miss that. So what do I do?
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. First of all, there's absolutely a place for you to use those skills in the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah.
I work with a fellow in my diocese who has a pretty long career in youth ministry, for instance, and young adult ministry. And he's also a talented musician and finds so many opportunities. He carries his guitar with him all over the place, and he's just whipping it out and singing songs all the time. He's even brought it into the chancery, to the diocesan office, and sung for us. And it's very edifying. There's a priest, he and the priest here in town have sort of gone on Eucharistic adoration tours, if you will, and he does music. And it's contemporary, but pious and contemplative, thought-provoking. Well, priest will offer some reflections on the Blessed Sacrament and our adoration, and then he accompanies people when they pray. And that's outside the context of the standard liturgy. And then he was involved in a ministry in New York with the Franciscans of the Renewal called Catholic Underground, where they have these kinds of events on Friday night and Saturday nights and bring in young people and play music and have art and engage them culturally and in the faith as well. I mean, there's so many opportunities to use this kind of ministry outside the context of the liturgy.
Maybe not at each and every parish, but certainly within the diocese.
No, and throughout the diocese, to be sure. And even within the parish, I mean, a lot of times there are parishes that have different liturgies at different times, sort of targeting different age groups and demographics, and you may find something in that vein also. So I really think that there's going to be a place for you someplace within the Catholic world. Now, that being said, this can also be a cross for you that you can offer up to God. Now, I like to do catechesis. So I like to teach and talk about the Catholic faith. I really enjoy that. I became Catholic in 2003, and I went about 7 years with radio silence, no pun intended, where I did very little in the way of catechesis. And I marched into a couple parishes and said, you know, I like to teach and blah, 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 blah. And it was just crickets. Mm-hmm. I got nowhere for a while. I now believe that time in the desert was providentially arranged for me by God, because I had to work on other things in my life, in my Catholic life, other than how I was going to use my gifts, guitar playing, not one of them. And I had to work on my marriage, had to work on my family, had to work on my kids, had to work on my prayer life, my sacramental life. And of course, your primary vocation, if you're a married fellow, maybe you're not married, I'm not sure, but if you're married, your primary vocation, of course, is going to be to your family life. And of course, you can use your gifts there as well. So I'd tell you also, A, there's going to be something for you. B, be patient. And the fact that you don't feel like you're using your gifts doesn't mean that God doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't have a purpose for that. And there can't be some reason. I can't tell you the number of, read the lives of the saints. You'll find all kinds of people who said, well, God wanted me to hang this up. And they went a while without using it. And lo and behold, some religious superior or some pastor grabs hold of them, you know, 5 years later and says, wow, you're really good at X. We're going to put you to use. And they find a whole new field of apostle that they didn't anticipate. Once they gave it up, once they surrendered it to God, all of a sudden they start being more fruitful than they can possibly imagine. And then finally, third consideration, if it comes to making a living, if it comes to, you know, you need a paycheck, there's nothing intrinsically immoral about a Catholic using musical gifts and getting a paycheck for it in other contexts.
Right.
Tom, your wife, Adrienne, only likes to sing sacred music, but she's done so in professional choirs outside the Catholic Church, and she's very talented in it and gets a lot of pleasure from it, but also helps pay the bills from time to time, right?
Indeed.
You know? And we've got a lot of musicians in the Catholic world in Birmingham who sort of moonlight as organists and so forth at other churches around town because, you know, they got to pay the bills. And that, you can do that.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? There's Catholic singers on the national stage who are at the top of their game right now, people like Matt Maher, fantastic musicians. So keep the faith there, Joe, and thank you so much for your call. Let's go over to Kona, Hawaii, and talk with Rumpel. Hey there, Rumpel, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Father. My mind is, my question is regarding the Genesis chapter 6, where it says, let us make man in our image. And so this passage, who is referring to is when it says, let us, is he referring to the Holy Spirit, the Trinity, or who is he referring to?
Yeah, thank
you. And when they said, let us make man in our image, they didn't say in our images. They said in our image. Mm-hmm. That's been cool.
Yes, I appreciate it. So there's no need to read into this a plurality. This can just be a sort of honorific, the way royalty use the royal we. And it is pretty clear from the context of Genesis and the entire Bible that God is a unity, and this is just a figure of speech to indicate God's majesty. It doesn't imply in this text.
Yeah.
We don't have to read a plurality within the Godhead out of this text. Now, the unfolding of the dogma of the Trinity is something that we learn over the course of sacred history. There are commentators who want to see intimations of that in this passage, but I don't know that it's necessary to read it that way.
Okay. Thank you so much for checking in from Hawaii, Rumpel. We love to hear from everybody here on EWTN's Call to Communion. We're going now to Peter, who's driving through Wyoming, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Peter, what's on your mind today?
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for the work that you do. Dr. Anders, I recall that back, I don't know, maybe it was 4 or 6 months ago, you were talking about, I think it was in graduate school, one of your fellow students sort of took you through the book of Romans from a more Catholic perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he wasn't a Catholic.
I imagine that, right, yeah, I think he was a former Baptist who perhaps even was an atheist, if I recall.
That's correct.
Or agnostic. Did that turn a light on you with regard to the difference sort of between the way a Catholic understands works versus works of the law and the way a Protestant does? And if you could just go through how exactly that changed your thoughts about the book of Romans.
Sure. And I've only got about a minute to go, so I'll do the best I can, but we can always come back to this next week if you want to. So it wasn't just that conversation. There was a whole host of things that began to influence me, beginning with reading St. Augustine of Hippo, Catholic doctor of the Church, 4th century North Africa, particularly because Augustine is so highly regarded by most Protestant scholars as kind of an exemplar interpreter of the Book of Romans and Galatians and teacher on the nature of grace. And I saw how little like Luther or Calvin Augustine was, and that was a big eye-opener for me. Others were not only my friend that you mentioned in graduate school, but other Protestant scholars who have sort of revisioned how they read the Pauline corpus, none more important to me than the Anglican historian and theologian N.T. Wright, and kind of a summation of Wright's view. You can find it in his book titled Justification. Another one would be Christer Stendahl, the Lutheran biblical scholar from Harvard University, his book Paul Among Jews and Gentiles. And then finally, of course, E.P. Sanders, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, another tremendously important influence on what's come to be known as the New Perspective on Paul movement. That whole genre of literature, very, very significant for me. And then finally, Alistair McGrath, who's an evangelical historian. So all these guys are Protestants. Alistair McGrath, his two-volume book on the history of justification, Justitia Dei, was instrumental. And McGrath in particular, because he demonstrated that the Protestant interpretation of these texts is entirely novel, that it has no basis in a precedent in Christian tradition, not just Catholic tradition, but any Christian tradition up until the 15th century. He actually says Luther's interpretation is a theological novum, an utter novelty, a complete innovation that he kind of pulled out of his head. Yeah. Now, in terms of the proper way to read the text, unfortunately, I hear the music. We're going to have to come back to it. But I'll tell you this, and I got this from Stendahl. Anytime you want to know what Paul means or the New Testament means, ask yourself the question, what does this have to do with the relationship between Jews and Gentiles? That's the interpretive framework you bring to St. Paul, because it's the one that he himself establishes as his key issue.
Right, right.
And once you read it in that light, you see it in a completely different light. Luther's mistake was to read Paul as if Paul were writing within the context of late medieval Catholic devotionalism, which of course he wasn't.
That's right.
So Luther brought to the text a whole set of questions with which Paul was just simply unconcerned.
Sure. Peter, thank you so much for your call. Sorry we couldn't get to Donna in St. Louis. Donna, please call us back Monday. We'll get to you at the beginning of the hour. Hey, Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Tom.
Everybody have a great weekend. We'll see you then. God bless.